and and what's going on, and listening to Saturday Morning Live, having a little problems with, you know, community radio tech stuff. It's awesome. But, you know, we still keep it moving. And this is Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen. I am back from the Caribbean. I don't know how I feel about that right now. But I'm here. I'm happy to be here. And sorry for the listeners. Just wanted to shout out that, yes, we've been having a little bit of technical difficulties over the show. But we still made it through, and I hopefully everybody was still enjoying and getting a lot of information and stuff like that. But this is, we're really blessed to have an author, an activist, a friend, Zainab Amadahi, and she's a writer, and she is here to talk about her wonderful book called Wielding the Force, The Science of Social Justice. Welcome to the studio. And
thank you, Mally.
Hold on.
Uh-oh.
Hold on.
Am I any better now? Or
No, it's I think it's this end over here.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on. We're just having technical difficulties. We're gone. Maybe try the, can you help her get the other mic? And maybe that will help. Yeah.
Is this mic doing it for us?
Okay. So that's, we're going to go to a track and fix up that. And we'll go back to Deborah Cox. And we'll be back.
Me how I knew my true love was true. I, of course, replied, something here inside cannot be.
We're back. Yes. Gosh. I think we got it. Yes. Yes.
And as I was saying, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. And it's wonderful to be here.
Let's go right into it. So maybe talk about the journey of, you know, putting together this book, and maybe a little bit of how you came to actually writing this book.
Right. Well, I don't even know where to begin in terms of describing the journey, so I'm going to end up starting somewhere in the middle. But of course, you know, I've had my own challenges as an activist in terms of staying balanced and, you know, maintaining, you know, an emotional, you know, an emotional balance where I'm doing my activism out of a sense of love and care for the community, as opposed to, you know, the anger that I was carrying around with me. And I think many of us do carry around, you know, a very, you know, logical, you know, anger in response to some of the things that we have to deal with in society. But yeah, so I've always had that difficulty in terms of, you know, I was in my youth quite angry, and you know, it started to sabotage, you know, other parts of my life, as it will do. I also have had my struggles with personal illness and that kind of thing. And so, and I'm also a science fiction writer. So oddly enough, all of those things kind of like intersected, you know, as I did my research for writing and my research for keeping well. And, you know, I found some ways, you know, of kind of looking at some of the emotional journeys that I was taking, and looking critically at some of the work that I was doing in and with the community. And then there was a spiritual component to this as well, which I didn't put it in the book to a great degree, and I don't talk about it a lot, but there are some places I feel safer than others in talking about it, but the reality is that I feel like there were many times when I went to ceremonies or visions or dreams that I experienced where I feel like the ancestors, Mother Earth, and many spiritual beings out there were, and I'm sure many people get this particularly now because of the state that the Earth is in, but, I really felt that there were many signs that some kind of action was required, some kind of, and the book was basically where I think they were directing me. I'm not done with that work, but that was certainly first step that I think my ancestors were celebrating. So that's the long answer to your question.
That's a good answer. So maybe talk, there's maybe a summary for those of people who don't know of the book and what it's about.
Right. Well, what I look at in the book is some new cutting edge emerging science, and what it has to say about, ultimately what I'm looking at is what it has to say about social justice. But I don't start with that. I kind of start with looking at what it says about individual and personal well-being. I look at some of the science that's very well known and accepted in terms of like stress, the science of stress and what it does to our bodies and what it does to our relationships and all this sort of thing. And of course, that has a very negative impact on our well-being and our health and, stress, whether it's coming from anger or hatred or grief or depression or whatever, really does translate into disease and quite serious diseases and can be fatal to us. But now there's some new research looking at, what are the impacts of some positive emotions and positive actions. And it's really lovely. I mean, as a social justice activist, it was very validating to know that, grateful, optimistic, hopeful, kind, cooperative people get a payback, a very concrete payback in terms of their health and well-being. And so these things, these ways of being in the world are very healthy for us as individuals. But they also, again, should inform our vision of community justice and how we struggle for community justice. And that's where the book kind of takes us. I also think that, I think the book really argues very strongly for a paradigm shift, not one that is typically thought of in terms of social justice, where we talk about a paradigm shift from, capitalist colonial ways of being and thinking to, more leftist ways. I mean, I'm quite sympathetic to leftist ways of thinking, but what my book deals with is a shift in mindset and frameworks of knowing, ways of knowing, that recognize that we're not actually living in a material world. And I think that, much of the science, that has been out there for a long time is not, in popular culture as yet. It's seeping in little by little. But there's a lot of knowledge out there that you can't make a profit from. And so, it's taking a long time to get out into the consciousness of people. But basically, everything that we think of as matter, is actually, we should be far more concerned with, how energy impacts our lives and how energy impacts matter and how matter behaves than we've previously been told. Yeah.
Well, I guess that leads to sort of different paradigms that you talk about in the book. So maybe like talk about the difference between, the sort of mainstream paradigm and what you call the relational sort of paradigm, and what do you mean by paradigm or worldview, as you say?
Yeah, paradigm, worldview, ways of knowing. Basically, for me, I like to talk it's in examples, because I think when you tell the stories and you give the examples, it lands on people in a more concrete way. But basically, our worldview, our paradigms are kind of the frames, they're kind of like how we make sense of our world. It's the way that we organize what goes on in the world. And so, for example, one of the examples that I give in the book is that, you know, you're suffering from a headache, you know, in one worldview or in one way of knowing, you know, you can take an aspirin and you can, you know, be fairly sure that your headache, you know, will be relieved. In another worldview, you know, you might want to go to a healing ceremony because you might recognize that that headache, you know, has deeper roots. And so going through a healing ceremony and maybe even devoting a day or more than one day, maybe 3 days, to get at the root of, you know, that pain, you know, might end up relieving your headache and actually over the long term, relieving it over the long term. So, and I don't know if you wanted me to talk about some of the differences in the worldviews or.
Yeah.
So, I think the dominant mainstream colonial Eurocentric worldview, you know, is interested in a world that is very linear, is interested in a world that is provable, that is very material. You know, and I think I like looking at left and right brain to kind of bring this home to people. So your left brain, again, the way it processes information and looks at the world and even formulates questions is one that's very linear. It likes to deal with, you know, numbers. It likes to deal with ordered things, you know, sequentially or, you know, shape sizes, that kind of thing. And it's reductionist, so it kind of looks at how it understands something by looking at its smaller component parts. So it looks at the world, it tries to understand how the human body behaves, for example, by looking at cells, and then looking at how cells behave by looking at the molecules, and looking at how molecules behave by looking at atoms, and looking at how atoms behave by looking at subatomic particles and on down. The relational worldview understand something by looking at the whole thing and how the whole kind of interacts with other wholes. And so understanding the human body or understanding the human body is less about understanding its component parts than looking at, you know, it looks at how the body relates to other life forms and other two-leggeds on the planet. And it looks at, you know, how organs relate to each other and how systems relate to each other and how our emotions, for example, might impact, you know, how our organs function, how our relationships might impact our well-being, and so on. And when we, for example, if we're trying to understand how a plant, you know, works in the world, whether a plant might be useful to us, the way we would get that information is not by taking the plant out of its environment and dissecting it and looking at it under a microscope and looking at how it reacts to different chemicals, but more about looking at how that plant is in its place. So looking at how it behaves through the seasons, looking at how it interacts with other plants, with other animals, with other insects, and so on. So those are the kind of two different ways of looking at the world. And they aren't as opposite as you would think, because our brain certainly integrates those ways of knowing into one. But as societies, we don't do that. It's one way or the highway.
Yeah, and basically we kind of people learn or use their left brain a little bit, or are trained to use it more than looking at the whole picture kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, it figures that.
Yeah, in our institutions in mainstream society, and this is a global issue at this point, you know, if you connect to institutions and you go to these, you know, you go to schools and things like that, it's your left brain skills that are cultivated and trained. And because of what we know about neuroplasticity, which basically mean that the brain, what we think, shapes our brain, like literally restructures our brain moment to moment. And so if we spend more time, you know, on one thing, if our focus is on one thing as opposed to another, then we're going to develop those skills at the expense of the other, right? So the more time we spend cultivating our left brain in schools and in the other institutions in the society, you know, if we don't have, you know, an artistic component or a spiritual component to our lives, then that left brain gets strengthened while our right brain kind of literally diminishes. And this has been shown in science that, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And so there's, you know, there's less blood supply to that part, to certain parts of the brain that we don't use. There's less what they call neurogenesis. So, you know, less brain cells are allocated to those functions if we're not using them. And we can change that, of course. That's the wonderful thing about neuroplasticity, is that we can totally change that at any time in our lives. We can be in our 90s and decide that, you know, we want to learn to play the piano or dance or garden or whatever it is we want to do. And those skills will develop, or the brain will develop to facilitate those skills. But again, yeah, most of us tend to be more left brain because that's what the society values. Yeah.
And it's interesting that you say that you could do it at any time, because you're taught that if you don't, you have a window. If you don't learn something within, like, you know, your early part of your life, you can never sort of develop that skill. It's over, right? Yeah. And so your book shows that, you know, your brain is amazing in that you kind of can train it at any time.
Exactly.
So
I mean, that's been proven again. So I mean, and we don't know the limits to neuroplasticity, and I'm not here to suggest, and I don't think any neuroscientist would suggest that, you know, if there is a congenital issue. I mean, I have one of my sons is disabled, and he has a lot of congenital issues, and he has survived, and he has capacities that when he was a child, they told me he would never have. There's no question about that. But, you know, will he ever, be able to function? Will his challenges be overcome? Probably not. But there's a certain quality of life that he enjoys that if we had believed the doctors when he was young, he would never be enjoying at this point. You know, the doctors, actually, my son is 36 years old, since he was 3 years old, he was kind of given, you know, no more than a year to live, right? So that is just one personal story that I have in terms of, acknowledging and recognizing and honoring the power of our brains. But yeah, so it's possible at any time for any place for anyone to shift their focus, and it starts with a shift in focus. There's an example that I give in the book about a neuroscientist who was looking at volunteers who wanted to learn how to play the piano, and so they practiced for 5 days playing the piano. I think they did an hour a day. And after a mere 5 days, their brain started to show significant difference in the part that was responsible for finger movements, so fine motor movements. And then, you know, he looked at people who were just thinking about playing the piano but actually didn't have a piano. And so what these people would do just for an hour a day for 5 days, they would hold their hands out in front of them. There would be no piano. There would be no movement. They were not to move their hands, but they were just supposed to imagine that they were playing the piano. And after 5 days, when they did the fMRI, which is a brain scan, they found that the brains of people who were only thinking about playing the piano had changed in exactly the same way as those who had actually been learning to play. So there was more blood supply to that area of the brain. There were more cells that had generated, and there were more neural pathways, so more communication among the cells in that area of the brain. So again, an example of how powerful our brains are.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to maybe bring it back to the journey of coming to this book, and because there's a chapter where you kind of speak of, you know, your growing up. So I don't know if you feel comfortable in sharing that, but some of sort of the influence of you growing up and your life. Growing up, from maybe talk about, you know, your childhood and coming up. I don't know, whatever you want to share, kind of thing. Because I thought that was really powerful. I really enjoyed that chapter.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a hard question because I'm so old. Where to begin?
No.
My background is, my father is both African American and Cherokee, and we used to go around saying he was, you know, half and half kind of thing, but we actually don't know the exact percentages. Both of his parents were half and half as well, and he was brought up in the community of Staunton, Virginia. And originally he comes from, you know, I mean, both his African and Cherokee ancestors were enslaved on the Reynolds Tobacco Plantation. My mother's family is Portuguese, Scottish, and Amish, and they also have a lot of drama in terms of, you know, how they came to be on this land. They were, you know, obviously they were settlers, but she was brought up in a very violent and racist context. In fact, my grandfather was a card-carrying member of the Ku Klux Klan. And so my parents somehow hooked up, made a bunch of kids, and I'm one of them. And yeah, so they were also activists, in terms of, you know, what was going on at the time that I was growing up. I mean, my mother was an activist before I was born, and she used to tell stories about being pregnant with me and going to these civil rights demonstrations where people would spit on her and call her the N-word, you know, an N-word lover kind of thing, you know. And so they grew up with a lot of this violence around them. There was a lot of violence within the family, a lot of domestic violence. And, you know, so those are the life and times that I grew up in. And it really shaped me as an activist. And I got involved quite young in the civil rights, Black Power movement. In high school, I wasn't, my parents didn't often bring me to activist events because, you know, in those days it was really quite dangerous and can be in these days too. But in those days it was, you know, you never knew seriously what was going to happen. But when I was in high school, I made my own commitment to the movement and was an activist at that time. So I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but that's kind of where it all began.
Yeah. So I wanted to also talk a little bit about, I guess people's relationship and sort of paradigm with like systems, right? Like, because you talk about that a little bit in the book, through an example, I think through Gail Maurice's film, right? Just talking about like people's relationship to. And or sort of trauma that they get inflicted with, you know, their relationship with systems, specifically, you know, colonized and marginalized people, and how that affects, I guess, people's emotions, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, I can tell you the story that's chronicled in Gail Maurice. Gail Maurice is a Cree filmmaker, and one of her films, Thirst, she talks about her journey to Kiwewin First Nation. This would have been probably maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. And so she was in Kiwewin to do a filmmaking workshop with youth there. And she noticed while she was there that a lot of the children had sores on their skin. And, you know, she was curious about that and took a sample of the drinking water, the community's drinking water, brought it back to Toronto when she got back here, had it tested on her own dime, because Indian Affairs isn't likely, but anyways. So she had that water tested and found out that it was contaminated with uranium. And, you know, I talked to her a little, you know, while I was writing the book, and she doesn't know what the outcome of all of this was, but she does know that the government started to fly in bottled water for the purposes of drinking and cooking, but of course it's very expensive, and so people were still showering and washing their dishes and in the contaminated water. So in the book, I talk about the story in a couple of contexts. I put it into a couple of contexts, and one of them is to look at how, you know, because again, when Indigenous people, at least my interpretation, my understanding from my teachings, when Indigenous people kind of look at the question of wellness, they want to see what your relationships are, your relationship to yourself, you know, to your body. They want to look at your relationships, your familial relationships, your relationships with your ancestors, your relationships to land, and so on. And so we look at all of these relationships and try and figure out, you know, what needs to be shifted so that a person can become well again. And what New Agers have done with this kind of knowledge is that they've kind of taken it up and said, and their interpretation of it is, well, you know, if you're thinking certain thoughts or you're doing certain things, you know, then you're kind of responsible for any and everything that comes into your life, as though we exist as individuals, but we don't. And so the Kiwewin example, one of the ways that I use what happened in Kiwewin is kind of to look at how our relationships to each other as communities and how our worldviews interrelate and interact with each other also impact wellness. And so here we see an example of a relationship that is rooted in colonization, that is rooted in, you know, an understanding of land as just, you know, waiting to be exploited for its resources. And so when you have that kind of a mindset that indigenous lives don't matter, they're just in the way of resources, when you have a kind of mindset that says that the land is only there to exploit and make us rich, you know, this is an example of what can happen. And my feeling is that we're all responsible at some level, responsible in the sense that we all have the capacity to respond to this kind of a situation. And it does, for me, the core of that is in our relationships and how we relate to each other as communities, to each other as individuals, and to how we relate to the other life on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think also in, you know, the mainstream paradigm and, you know, everything is like sort of shifting accountability. And I think within the relational paradigm, it's sort of, you know, every relation has an accountability. You have an accountability to a certain, either it's the land or people in your community. And I think within a capitalist framework, it's a constant shifting of accountability, right? You know, or denying accountability, I guess.
Yeah. And I talk a lot about responsibility instead of accountability. And my attempt is to try to illustrate how these things always, what we put out into the world comes back to us in some way or another. But we also are not as individuals. Like I say, we're not individuals. And so often what we put out into the world, yes, it does come back to us eventually, and usually with a larger energy, but we also are putting it out into the world. And so, you know, we're always impacting each other all the time at every level. And we are all responsible for that. We are all responsible for the energies that we radiate, for the things that we think, say, and do. And, you know, we're responsible as individuals, but we're also responsible as groups, as communities, and as societies. And I guess I hope that I make the point in the book that, you know, in the same way that we can kind of look at disease in the body, you know, I mean, we can look at, you know, how wellness in the body functions, where all the parts of the body, all the organs and all the cells cooperate and communicate with each other, you know, and then a disease comes along and you know, creates an imbalance, and that, you know, the body mobilizes so many energies, so many forces to get rid of that disease. And I kind of hope I've made the case that, you know, capitalist ways of knowing and colonial ways of thinking are kind of a disease on Mother Earth, you know, it's kind of like an autoimmune disease where people are kind of like, it's like cancer, you know, where we're kind of destroying ourselves, and it's insane. So, yeah.
So you had a book launch at Maywork, so maybe you want to talk about that. How did that go?
It was beautiful, and I thank everyone who attended and contributed to the discussion. It was wonderful. Mayworks has been a wonderful supporter, and it was a lovely experience, and I enjoyed doing those kinds of things very much because, you know, not everybody reads. I mean, it's great that people do read, and they can certainly get a lot out of the book, but not everybody does read, and I think there are many, many ways in which people can absorb the information, and if there are ways that I can, you know, help this information get out there, I'm really anxious and happy to do it. Yeah.
Well, so maybe tell listeners where you can people could contact you and get the book.
Sure. Well, the book is available on Amazon.com, and there's an ebook version as well. And if you go to Smashwords, you'll be able to find that. My website can give you links to both places, as well as update you on some of the things that I'm doing in the community, the workshops that I'll be doing. So my website is www.swallowsongs.com. I have a workshops upcoming at Accents Bookstore. There'll be one coming up at another story bookstore, and there's other activities that are on my website that you can check out. So again, it's www.swallowsongs.com. Thank you.
Cool. Do you have anything upcoming? Like really coming up soon, or
Well, the accents thing is coming up. There's something that I'm forgetting. Actually, if you had my website up there,
yeah,
I can't remember. There's something on the 19th. I know that's coming up, but I can't remember what it is.
Was there anything you wanted to say? Like, yeah. What do you think? What was the most impactful thing in writing this book?
Well, for me, the book, I think that any kind of artistic project or creative project, you know, can and should be transformational. And this writing this book was incredibly transformational to me. It was a healing journey. And that's the hope that I hold for anybody who reads the book or comes to any of my workshops, that I become a part of their healing journey and that this information become useful to them. I really think that this information, I'm not the only source of it, of course, but I do think that this sort of information, you know, holds a lot of potential for transforming the way we struggle, the way we work together, and also transforming, you know, our vision of social justice, ultimately transforming the world and the way we relate to it. Yeah.
Cool. So I'm on your upcoming. It's Saturday, May 18th at Accents Bookstore. It's 3 to 5. And it's, I guess it's going to be sort of a discussion around your book, yes?
Yeah, it's going to be a workshop where I kind of lead people in a process where they actually get to experience the mind-body connection, and they get to experience some of the concepts that I talk about in the book. And engage with that material in a very hands-on kind of a way, yeah.
Yeah, so it's Saturday, May 18th, which is next week, isn't it?
Could be. It's Saturday. I don't know. I think we're all in the same shape. You just got back, and yeah. I'm like, you know.
Yeah. Did anybody else have any questions? Adrian? Norman? Huh?
No.
No, I'm just boring.
No, you are not.
I don't mind giving a plug, too. Adrian Worrell also has just self-published a book of poetry, so check him out on Facebook, and I don't know where else he is, but he's an amazing writer as well.
Exactly.
And and I really, you know, I also want to talk about, you know, I mean, I really want to give a plug for to self-publications and self-publishers, because you know, I still think publishing has its role, but I'm really excited about the potential that we have these days as filmmakers, as artists of any kind, to be able to have that direct relationship with our audience. And, you know, this is a really wonderful gift, the technology that we have, which can be used for evil, but in this case is being used for good. And I think it's really great. And so props to all the self-publishers out there.
Yeah, and I think that's exciting, because you're able to, you know, published as many times you know, as you are able to, and yeah, that direct link to the audience. You don't have to wait for, there's no middleman, you know.
Yeah for sure. And I still, like I say, I think publishing companies still have a role to play, but in my case, you know, with my ancestors kicking my butt, I really felt like, you know, time was of the essence. With my first book, I went with Sister Vision Press, which isn't around anymore. It took 3 years by the time I put the period on the last sentence to the time the book was actually in my hand. It took about 3 years. And that's, I mean, I love them. They did wonderful work, and it was a fiction book. It didn't matter, but that was a long time, and I felt with this particular book it couldn't wait. You know, we didn't have 3 years for this information to get out there. It's already late.
Zeynep, I was wondering what you plan to do in the future with regards to your writing and publishing. Because you've done science fiction stuff, you've done, I guess, this is social justice and nonfiction. So, pretty versatile. What's next, do you think?
Well, thank you. I am going to be following up this particular book, The Science of Social Justice. I'll be following that up with more practical booklets, so the how-to. So this book kind of dealt with more the theory of, you know, what's going on in our world and how to look at it and how we can benefit from this knowledge. Then I'm going to look at how do we actually, you know, utilize this information in our groups, in our collectives, in our organizations. So there'll be some booklets coming out. I'm also working on a science fiction series. So the first of a three-book series is going to be coming out. It takes place in a dystopic future Toronto, where, you know, our the economy, the capitalist economy, has collapsed, which it will. and so we're going to look at a community that's trying to survive and thrive, and corporations that are still trying to hang on. So that's the setup of that book. I also have a film that's going into, we're going to start shooting in June, so that's kind of exciting.
Wow, okay.
That's a science fiction comedy, so.
Just slide it in there. Oh, and by the way, I just happen to have this film that starts shooting next week.
Well, I've been wary of saying that because, you know, films take for frickin' ever. And, you know, people have been saying, oh, yeah, my film is in production, and they say that for like 10, 15 years, right? Because what in production means is you're trying to raise the money to do it, right? Well, yeah, so we're actually going into shoot in next month, and so that's kind of exciting. So, you know, I guess there's a chance that this might be out fairly soon, within the next year. So
nice. And you said it's
great.
A science fiction comedy.
Science fiction comedy, yeah.
Okay, I think we need more of that for sure.
Well, I was going to ask, so you kind of asked the question that I wanted to ask, what's up next kind of thing.
The work here is done.
What's next for you, Adrian and Mally?
Yeah.
I don't know, Tim Horton's coffee, maybe? Not a movie, I'll tell you that.
actually get, like, a fan page so we can become fans.
Yes, that's the plan. I'm going to get on top of the whole marketing and promotion aspect of the self-publishing thing, which is, you know, it's pretty vast. There's so many things you got to do, right? And then I'm focusing on just trying to get stuff done and have it sound or look or a particular way. Mm-hmm. So the marketing aspect is something I don't pay much attention to. But ironically, you do get a lot of inspiration from marketing, you know, because you interact with people and people give you good feedback or not good feedback, but it's still feedback. Yeah. And it helps the work become in some ways more real. So I do intend to get on top of that a little bit more, but being a little bit of a recluse.
Well, the thing, I think for me, like, I don't like to call it, like, marketing because it sounds so, like, you know, advertising.
Sure.
So I say it's, like, your connection to your audience, right? And, like, your relationship with your audience, right?
Yeah, that's
like,
a better way of putting
it. Yeah. Yeah. And you need, yeah.
Yeah, building relationships with your audience. Yeah, right. That's lovely. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that piece of it usually is hard for people like us. Because we've been, you know, I mean, marketing is about lying, like, a lot of times. Honestly, it's about lying to people and creating expectations that can't be fulfilled and stuff like that. But I think this is more about, you know, trying to heal, you know, and trying to help people, you know, make transformations that are going to make them and the world better. So, yeah, I like that, Molly. I'm going to use that from now on. Developing relationships with our audience, you know. And I think, you know, again, just if there are self-publishers out there listening, that piece of it is very difficult. I mean, we like to think of ourselves as gentle, artistic souls. And on my recent trip, I was in New Zealand a little while ago, and I met with a Maori woman who just had these amazing abilities. And they don't have bears down there, but I have a bear spirit that travels with me. And she met my bear, and she was telling me all about what my bear wanted to tell me and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, one of the things she was saying to me is that, you know, you have this nice gentle energy, which was really great in terms of creation, but now you have to get a little more masculine in your energies. Not gender stereotyping, but I mean, we categorize energies in this way. And she said that, you know, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to create, and but it's not useful if it just sits there. You really have to engage and recognize that you're not the only person out there, you know, doing it, that there are many other people that you'll connect with, and you just create a larger energy together and support each other and help each other transform this world. But I was saying, you know, earlier to Adrian that you don't have to, you know, there is a million things that you can do in terms of building this relationship, and but don't try and do them all at once. Take them one at a time. You know, once you get, you know, one or two things, you know, you build your website. Once you get that under control, move on to the next step of social media, then move on to the next step or whatever is appropriate for whatever you're doing. You don't have to do it all at once, because that's just crazy and that makes you sick. And we don't want sick people.
Yeah. So get on that.
Yes. Yes.
What's next for me? I'm really like, usually when I go away, I come back, you know, with some kind of energy. And cause I was really burnt out before I left, and I was really inspired in the Caribbean, and I'm excited to actually just continue the work that I was doing here before with, you know, a little bit more, you know, I guess distance, you know, helps, you know, bring back that energy to the work that you were previously doing. So, yeah, I'm excited to be here on the show, building actually the, you know, the infrastructure for this show, and, you know,
yeah,
creating community radio. So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate the work you do in the community as well, Molly. I mean, there's the film work, and this radio work is awesome. Like, so yeah, I really appreciate, yeah, all of this work that promotes, again, it helps, you know, all of us promote each other and builds this community, and builds these movements that we're trying to build to make these changes. So thank you.
Did you have anything else?
That's it. Also, we can't forget Norm's book. Everybody has something Norman. Going. Norm's here quiet Norman, looking through his address book. But a rich historical, music historical book. What's that? It's your book we're talking about.
So come and say, yeah, come and say your little two-piece.
Hello, Toronto. I'm trying to put together a book on, basically it's a collection of essays that have already been published and a few new things, but, you know, I started out with contrasts, and, you know, I wrote for Cher and the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and I wrote for the National Post for quite a while. And so basically I'm putting together those essays, political and music. I'm mixing politics and music, and, you know, like, it'll be things in there from Fela Kuti to Whitney Houston. And, you know, everything has a political spin in, you know, the stuff that I'm writing about, because I know that I maintain that what took place in the 60s when you had John Coltrane and you had Malcolm X, that was in the 60s. In the 70s you had Bob Marley and Walter Rodney, and in the later on you had Fela and you had Thomas Sankara, you know, the people compliment one another. And, you know, there's an essay that I wrote about Marion McCabe, which I can't, you know, I can't carry. I mean, I can't find this essay. It was written in a Ryerson publication. So basically it's Pan-Africanism in music. I'm dealing with North America, United States and Canada, as well as the Caribbean and African, and Europe, because, I mean, our people are all over the world. And so that's basically, I'm just trying to record, put it out there for the next generation, because I think that this generation is ready for, you know, what took place wants to know about what, there's a significant element of people that really want to know about what took place before they came on the set. And so that's basically what I'm working on. Hopefully I can get it out in and very shortly. I mean, very shortly.
Yeah.
Very shortly.
Yeah, I just had a brief look at the manuscript, and I have to say that I think this is going to be an amazing collection of writings. You know, it took me back for sure, but I think that, you know, when you're an artist, I mean, this is about music, but when you're an artist and you're kind of working on your work, sometimes you don't want to know about the contribution that you make to history. You know, and I think that, you know, this book shows you, you know, the contributions, positive, negative, and in between that... so many musicians have made to movements and to people's lives, and it's going to be quite remarkable. And we all need to, you know, we all need to be reminded as well that, you know, history does judge us, and the generations to come will judge us. And so it's another reminder of that kind of thing. But I think it's going to be a very powerful archive of some of the ways that music has contributed in positive and negative ways. You did. You found a picture of me
demonstrating in front of the Royal York. I don't know who it was against, but it was in the 80s, I believe.
Yep, that probably would have been part of the anti-apartheid, South African apartheid divestment struggle. So yes, I used to do this.
It might have been Rita Coolidge, or I don't remember, but yeah. I have the photograph. I thought I had actually shared that with you. I haven't.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another reason for me to look forward to the book coming out.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you so much, Zainab, and I hope you come back.
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you're welcome anytime. And so, yeah, we're going to go to a track, and that kind of wraps up our show. It's now 1 o'clock, and we're going to be back in the whirlwind next week.
That's the roaring lion man, that's the Papa Chunks man, you don't understand? Watch me, you say you whine and you wiggle and you joke and you turn to the ring bang with the lion. Me say you whine and you wiggle and you joke and you turn to the ring bang with the lion. This is the lion, me say a legend, a star. The people, they come from near or far, whether you're old or whether you're young, you know that the lion come for roll the tongue right up, straight up. Me say lyrics to the max, say what's the lion man say, my launch and attack, sing it.
Don't kill me because I got the luck, the looks, the wear and then the pluck. Don't kill me because I got the luck, the looks, the wear and then the pluck. It's jealousy that really have them so in dread, the women and them want to take me head. Whoa! They call me Papa Chunks, the girls and them call me Sunkulums. I heard they talk, they call me Papa Chunks, the women and them call me Sunkulums. When I was born, everybody made a fuss in order to touch me. This they did, of course, put on a glove and touch me very light. Silk cotton mattress for me to sleep at night. Bathe me in milk and as a towel rust to rough. They rub me with a sweet little powder puff. Whoa, they call me Papa Jones. The girls and them call me Sunkulums. I hear they talk, they call me Papa Jones. The girls and them call me Sunkulums. Choice but 12 o'clock of Christmas night. Deep blue eyes and my skin was really white. Velvet hair flowing round my head. 5-point star out of veins on my forehead. Girls from everywhere around me took the seat to admire the one they called the sheep. Whoa, they call me Papa Chunks. The girls and them call me Sunkulums. I hear the gossip, they call me Papa Chunks. Everybody call me Sunkulums. I don't like that at all. Doctor or a lawyer, but the salary too small. Bishop, but again, that's too biblical. So I became QRC principal. I became a doo-doo man and so. In my spare time, I could sing me calypso. Whoa, they call me Papa Jones.
The girls and them call me Sun Kulung. Sing it out loud, they call me Papa Chung. The girls and them call me Sun Kulung.
Step up, got a new style come. Step up, step up with the roaring lion. Step up, watch a new style come. Step up with the roaring lion. Him a the Papa Chung's man. Yes, the man is the Chung Kulung's man. Me say him a the Papa Chung's man. Watch the man, him a the Chung Kulung's man. Watch it with the jacket, the tie, the cane in his hand. Everybody know that's the roaring lion. The jacket, the tie, the cane in his hand. Everybody know that's the roaring lion. Yeah.